You're listening to the Ref Recap Podcast on 960theref.com. Here are your hosts, Sam Franco and Ryan Goldstein.
All right, welcome into another episode of the Ref Recap Podcast right here on 960theref.com. Sam Franco and Ryan Goldstein along with you. You can follow on Twitter at Sam J. Franco, at TheRealRyGuy19, and of course, at 960 The Ref. You can also find 960 The Ref on Facebook, facebook.com/960TheRef. And unfortunately, our two local teams had a bad weekend, I guess. One had a bad loss, and the other had a game stolen from them.
Yeah, I wouldn't even really call it the Falcons a bad weekend, because I feel like we still feel the same way about the Falcons as we did before the game started. At least I do. I might even feel better about them. So it's one of those things that while we didn't get the W, and we'll get more into this later, you still feel that coming back from Seattle, the Falcons are going in the right direction. While Georgia, on the other hand, if we were doing stocks right now, they are trending downward. And I would probably sell immediately.
Yeah, you got that right. Stock is down, and we will start our conversation off today with the Dogs and the 17-16 loss to Vanderbilt between the hedges for homecoming. Not a good look losing to Vanderbilt, and unfortunately, Georgia obviously had their chances to win this game, but I think first and foremost, the thing you got to talk about here is the 4th-and-1 call to pitch the ball to Isaiah McKenzie and leave Sony Michel off the field and put Nick Chubb in as the fullback on that play.
Well, the weird thing about it was they had the same look. They called a timeout, and then they ran back onto the field with the same look. And then after the fact, Derek Mason, the head coach of Vanderbilt, says they came out with the exact same package and player personnel. So it just kind of goes to your thinking, well, if you're going to call a timeout, most of the time you would think that you would then change the play or at least change the look, because then you force the defense to have to think about it, you know, and change whatever they're going to do. Also, just hats off to Zach Cunningham, 19 tackles, defensive player of the week, you know, nationally. The guy is a baller.
Yeah, he is, and he's playing on Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt's got him, and they've got Ralph Webb, and that's pretty much it in terms of really, really marquee talent. So those two guys played well, especially with Webb catching that screen pass there in the lead up to Vanderbilt's go ahead touchdown. I mean, the biggest plays of the game were, as we mentioned, the 4th-and-1 there, and we'll kind of break that down a little bit more here in a second. But also the kick return to start the game, that was huge because you're basically spotting Vanderbilt 7 points. And then, as I mentioned, that screen pass that set up the touchdown for Vanderbilt, because Georgia brought the house on it, and it was the perfect play call in terms of the chess match there. It was a perfect play call to counter a full-out blitz, and Webb caught it and took it for a big gain down into Georgia territory, and that really set the Dogs back.
Well, and I think also the third facet of the game, in the sense that special teams has hindered the Dogs all season long, and Saturday was just another episode of it, as Kirby Smart called it, a comedy of errors. I mean, look, Reggie Davis steps out, you know, the second half kickoff. Like you said, the opening kickoff was run back, and then the Vanderbilt player after the game said, we saw a look from Georgia that led us to believe that we were going to be able to spring a long run. That's a problem if on the tape you see something and that you can just – I mean, special teams to me is one of those things that it should come down to. If you have some really talented players and better athletes, you should be able to – you shouldn't really be able to get out-schemed dramatically on special teams.
No, I agree with you. And unfortunately for Georgia, that's exactly what happened. And Vanderbilt, and even, you know, after the game they were talking about it, it's like, yeah, we ran a certain way of running kickoffs, and we just threw a little wrinkle in there, and Georgia kind of fell for it. So a little counter action is all they really did, and that caused Georgia to fall for it. But getting back to the McKenzie run, as you mentioned there, it was just strange that Georgia came out and they were lined up a certain way, and then they went right back out and were lined up the same way again. There's no need to reinvent the wheel, and I kind of feel like that's one of those where it just got in your head a little bit as an offensive coordinator, where you're trying to outthink the room. And sometimes it's just better to align my guys up against your guys and see if I can't get that push. And for Nick Chubb to be in as a blocking fullback on that play was weird. And, you know, Sony Michel also not being on the field there, also, you could pick your poison there with Sony or Nick in terms of trying to get that 1 yard. But Georgia called a weird play, and I'm sure that if they could do it over again, they'd do it differently.
Right, but the other thing is we shouldn't be in a position against Vanderbilt where we're having to go for it in the 4th-and-1 to
potentially win, or at least try to win the game.
Exactly, right? I mean, obviously that's what it came down to, But Georgia should and has more talent than Vanderbilt, where on a Saturday in Athens, we should be able to beat them and, like you said, not be in a position where you're having to go for it on fourth and one to then even put yourself in position to kick a field goal. Rodrigo Blankenship had a pretty good game, but you don't still feel, even if you get fourth and one, it's not as if the game is then over at that point.
Right. And, you know, I think that Rodrigo had a very good day. I think another thing where Georgia might have let it get into their head was when Vanderbilt called the two timeouts when Georgia was thinking about going for the field goal at the end of the first half, the 54-yarder. I'm not saying Rodrigo would have made it, but you initially said you were going to kick the field goal, then they called a timeout, then you sent the field goal unit back out, then they call another timeout, then you change your mind.
Well, and then you also brought out Bryce Ramsey as the holder the second time.
Right.
Which was the other thing that might have, you know, caught their eye and were like, well, what's Bryce Ramsey doing in the game? Now we have to call another timeout. It's one of those things that it's like you're having a chess match, but it's wasted time.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree.
And especially when you're watching the game, you're just like, okay, this is 10 seconds of play that takes 6 minutes of real time?
Right, yeah.
What's going on here?
Yeah, it was bizarre. And that was one special teams, I guess, mishap, if you want to call it that, for Georgia, just in terms of maybe not kicking that field goal. But the special team stuff was really bad, and we talked about it there with the return for Vanderbilt to start the game, basically spotting them 7 points. There was also those rugby-style punts that Vandy was employing, and Isaiah McKenzie and even Terry Godwin.
What
on
is
one
he doing?
Them, they were having trouble with that all
but
day.
But Isaiah McKenzie, though, he waves people off, and then he catches the ball, and then he runs. What do you – just somebody tell him that, you know
– you've got to be more sure-headed and sure-minded when you're doing that.
Right, because it just seems like there's too many times where every play he's making is a gamble. And I guess the thing is, players like Isaiah McKenzie, sometimes they break off those long runs and score touchdowns, and then you give them the benefit of the doubt. But then they make these plays where they, you know, they almost muffed a punt. It's just like, we need the ball, just catch the ball, fair catch it, or just let it bounce and hope that doesn't go into the end zone, right? I mean, there's different rules of where your feet should be, and if it goes over your head at the 15-yard line, just let it bounce regardless. So there just seems to be so many special teams blunders going on, and that was the thing with Rick, that he never had a special teams coordinator, and now these same problems are continuing under Kirby Smart. It just makes you think, you know, how hard can it be to shore up special teams?
Yeah, and even one of those punt plays where it ended up getting called back due to an illegal formation penalty, but Vandy's punter botched the snap, and Georgia should have been able to tackle him or get the ball or something there and have good field position. Instead, he got away and ended up doing one of those rugby-style punts for 61 yards.
It went over his head, right.
Yeah, and like I said, the play didn't end up counting, but still, it was pretty bad to watch. And then, obviously, Reggie Davis stepping out of bounds to field the opening second-half kickoff and stepping out of bounds on the three. I mean, that just can't happen.
Yeah, it just goes back to this idea that each week we have these problems and it's said, you know, we're working on it, but I'm not a football X's and O's technician, so I'm not going to proclaim that I understand how to fix the special teams problems, but it just seems that for an area of the game that's so vitally important, you would be able to shore these things up and not make little mistakes like that, because that's just attention to detail, stepping out on the 3-yard line, just understanding where you are and the awareness of, you know, the situation, where you are on the field to catch the ball. That to me is inexcusable. There are other things that you look and say, okay, I get that mistake's are made, but that to me is one of those things that you can't have happen.
No, and hopefully Georgia can shore up the special teams going forward, but it's looking right now like it's something that is just continuing to be a problem for Georgia.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's now comes out as the time when this is, up until this point, you know, the Nichols game we escaped, we beat Missouri on the road, but we hadn't had that loss where you really could say, okay, Kirby Smart has had a bad loss.
Mm-hmm.
Now he has that first bad loss. And you get the detractors out there that say, well, Coach Richt won 10 games. You know, why is he still not here?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to be that person because I think we need to make a change.
No, it's about, you know, sometimes the relationship gets stale. It's like,
agreed.
It's not even it's just sometimes you need to go in a different direction.
Exactly.
And I feel like that Georgia had gotten to that point.
Right, you need a different voice. But
And look at what Georgia is right now. No scholarship kicker. No scholarship punter. No scholarship long snapper. The wide receiving core is not where it needs to be.
They're tiny.
The offensive line is not where it needs to be. These are things that Coach Richt left Georgia with, not Kirby Smart problems. And Kirby needs some recruiting classes to fix this. This is not something that can be just fixed overnight.
That I agree with, but the only thing I'll say about this is if Coach Richt was here, we would expect 10 wins, and we probably wouldn't have lost to Vanderbilt. And I'm not saying it would have happened.
I don't know about all that. I mean, I don't know how you can say that. I mean, the talent on the team is the talent on the team.
Right, but it also seemed that we had a lot of the similar talent last year. It's not like we had just a mass exodus of the wide receivers. We didn't have, I guess we lost Malcolm Mitchell, but he'd been banged up.
I mean, would Brian Schottenheimer have been back? I mean,
well, I don't know. I don't know about all that, but I'm just saying with Mark Richt at the helm, there would have been changes made. I think Schottenheimer, I don't think he would have been here. And I also don't really like the argument, though, on the other side when people say, well, Alabama went, you know, 7-6 in Nick Saban's first year. The other difference is Kirby Smart's never won a national championship as a head coach.
Of course he wasn't,
you know, people didn't want him to be a head coach in the NFL. So I think my opinion of where the program is going has not changed. I think Kirby Smart is, they're headed in the right direction because it seems like recruiting is at an all-time high.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm encouraged by that, but I also don't think it's as easy. We're realizing it's not as easy as bring over the defensive coordinator from Alabama, plug him in, and things happen overnight. To your point about, you know, it takes time, but it just seems that this team is not as bad as losing to Vanderbilt.
Yeah, and one thing, you know, if we want to get on coaching, we can do that real quick because Georgia, for some reason, in these earlier kicks, it seems like the later the game kicks off, the better Georgia plays because these early kicks, you know, whether it be noon or, 11 a.m. Central Time when they kicked off against Ole Miss, they haven't been good in those games. But in the, you know, they obviously beat North Carolina in a 5:30 kick. The night kickoff against Missouri, they won that. It did take a last-ditch, you know, effort from Jacob Eason, but, hey, they won. They played much better against Tennessee than they have in some of these games, and they also beat South Carolina in a 2:30 kickoff. But all the other games kicked off at noon. Nichols, obviously, was a pretty bad performance, and so was the game against Ole Miss, and then so was this past weekend. So in some of these kicks that kick off a little, you know, earlier in the day, it seems like Georgia is coming out sleepwalking a little bit.
Well, I think that, and you look at, exclude Ole Miss, I guess, from this part because Ole Miss, I think, is just more talented and they wouldn't fit this argument that I'm about to make. But you look at the other team across the field and you say, well, they're not up to our standards.
Right.
Nichols, you didn't feel that they were a team that should be on the same playing field as you and they played that way. Georgia did. And the same probably with Vanderbilt. Oh, we have a bye week next week and then we have Florida.
So maybe showing a lack of respect.
Right. It's one of those things. Well, and it's, you know, it's a noon game, so it's earlier. The fans aren't as, you know, everyone hasn't been drinking all day. And
right.
So you're, the atmosphere is not maybe where, you know, a night game would be or a Tennessee 3:30 game would be because
mm-hmm.
the stakes are not as high. And you
right.
kind of, and I think just they're 18 to 22 year olds. So there inevitably is a little bit of a letdown factor, I think, because I think it's hard to, the best teams are the ones that can get up every week, whether it's Nichols or whether it's Alabama in the Dome.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a part of probably the learning process that, you know, Kirby will have to undergo and try to instill in his players that Alabama seems to have because they blow anybody out, whether it's Kentucky at noon or Tennessee on the road at 3:30.
Yeah. So, obviously, that's one something that needs to be adjusted because Georgia's probably going to be playing at noon a good bit more this season, so you got to get up and get ready
for some games.
Now the season
is over. I mean, look, you got Florida. You want to beat them. You have Auburn and Tech.
Yeah, you got Florida, Auburn, and Tech. I mean, those are games that you want to win.
And you want to win them, but it's one of those things that, and I was kind of calling for this after Tennessee because at that point you felt like you weren't making it to Atlanta. But look, the transition to some of these younger players, whether it's Mecole Hardman, whether it's some of these younger wide receivers, unless you're planning on redshirting them and you feel that that's the best course of action, you know, if they haven't played yet,
mm-hmm.
let's get some of these young guys in, get them some actual playing time, because playing time obviously is so much more valuable than practice. It's hard because you have these two great running backs in Sony Michel and Nick Chubb, but you don't want to just look over them and say, well, you know, this is kind of it. We're now looking towards the future.
Right.
But it has to be a little bit of that because you might as well use the season to the best of your ability, which I think is looking at 2017 and how you can make your team better for next year.
No, I agree. Some of the positives from this game, though, obviously Rodrigo Blankenship making those field goals is a good sign. I think we talked about it where his kicks have just looked better, but on Saturday we found out, well, they look better because they are better.
Right, and he can make a field goal.
It does kind of make you wonder, you know, what was going on in practice where William Hamm won the job in the first place. I'm not trying to throw a kid under the bus, but, I mean, it just looks clearly like Rodrigo Blankenship is
the better
kicker.
I'm not throwing him under the bus, but he's sitting under the bus right
now. Well, I mean, Rodrigo Blankenship has proven to be the better kicker. I mean,
Jacob Eason threw for 300 yards on Saturday.
He did. That was another solid sign. 346, 27 of 40. He did throw a touchdown. The back-to-back passes to Nauta where he hit him with that bullet pass, and then he dropped the one over the top. That touch is not something we've seen from Jacob Eason this season, and that's kind of been his biggest weakness, is not being able to put touch on passes. Well, he put some touch on that one, a little English on it to get it, dropping it over the top. It was a really nice touchdown there.
And Isaac Nauta is a stud.
Oh, yeah. That's,
I mean, that connection will be there for a few years to come. It'll be one that'll be very prolific.
Yes, it will be. So that was good to see. Although something that bothers me, and Dave and I have been talking about this, that Eason gets credit on those jet sweeps to McKenzie
for passing
yards. Like, how is that a passing play, man? Like, that's absurd.
Yeah, that's absolutely ridiculous.
That's so stupid. Like, that should be a running play. That should be
without
considered
a doubt
a running play.
But I guess it's because he just pitches it forward, so it counts
as
a pass.
But I mean,
yeah,
I guess that's a stylistic thing or whatever, and it really doesn't amount
to
a
lot. Well, that was like his first game against North Carolina. He had whatever. I don't remember his yardage, but I was like, this is a little... This is a little...
It's misleading.
Exactly, because, you know, two of those are jet sweeps to Isaiah McKenzie, and he got, you know, 25 yards.
And now it's the cocktail party. And yes, I called it the cocktail party because, well, that's what it's called. I don't, you know, care what they say that we should call it or not. But
who cares about what they want?
Yeah, exactly. Georgia and Florida down in Jacksonville. It's always a good time. And
you'll be there.
I will be there. I always go to that game. This will be a big game for Georgia, obviously. Georgia's lost two in a row in the series after winning the previous three. And the last two have been ugly. You know, there was the game 2 years ago where Florida basically just ran off tackle left, off tackle right the entire game.
And that was saving Will Muschamp's dignity at Florida.
Yes.
That was his last year there, and it was one of those, you know, we're going to win this one for the Gipper. And that was when Georgia was coming off of, it was the Todd Gurley suspension. They were coming off road games at Missouri and Arkansas. And you think at that point, oh, if we just get through Florida, we'll have Auburn coming home next, mm-hmm. and you couldn't beat Florida.
And last year was Fatone Bauta, and we don't really need to go a whole lot into that other than just, you know, throw
enough
our
said.
Hands up and say, "What? Why did you do that?" But Florida will be the best defense Georgia has seen this season, and they're playing at a really high level on defense, and Luke Del Rio coming back for them was huge. So this is a, you know, Coach Smart needs this win to kind of cool things down in terms of the – obviously, look, his job is nowhere close to being in jeopardy, but – just to kind of silence some of the noise a little bit.
It would be a huge win for them. Also to beat one of your biggest rivals, your biggest rival in the SEC, and just to get a win against a ranked team would be very positive coming off of a pretty atrocious Vanderbilt loss at home on homecoming.
Mm-hmm.
So look, if you can beat Florida, that's great. You can kind of salvage a season that at this point is, you know, has been one that you want to forget about.
Mm-hmm.
But you can say, look, we have some positives. We can look, if they can win out and beat Florida and Auburn and Tech, in Kentucky and Louisiana Lafayette, you can call it a fine season.
Yeah.
Not great, but you can salvage it.
Yeah. Switching gears now to the Atlanta Falcons, and I like your applause because it was a hell of an effort from Atlanta. They played very poorly in the first half, but they were able to have an incredible third quarter there, scoring 21 points. Matt Ryan able to throw for two touchdowns and 220 yards. In that, actually, three touchdowns.
Right, because it was Julio Sanu and then Troy Lolo.
That's right, three touchdowns there. Pardon me, pardon my incorrectness there. Three touchdowns, 220 yards in the third quarter. Just an unbelievable comeback for the Falcons to take the lead. And a game that, you know, they probably should have won. You know, Julio Jones drops the pass over the middle there, and Earl Thomas picks it off, setting up the, go-ahead field goal from Steven Hauschka, who had had an extra point blocked, missed a field goal as well, so it wasn't the greatest day overall for Hauschka, but still, they ended up getting that field goal they needed to get the win, despite the fact that Julio Jones was easily interfered with by Richard Sherman, and that was just unfortunate, because for the refs to miss that with a ref standing right there looking at it, I just don't know how you missed that. I saw a tweet from someone where you could see Sherman's hand grabbed around Julio's arm, and the caption on the tweet was, unless Julio has neon veins in his biceps, because there's like neon fingers on the gloves, and it was just maddening, man.
Yeah, it's frustrating because you feel that, like you said, they were out of it in the first half. They come back and have that great third quarter, and then some things had gone your way with the Hauschka missed, you know, blocked extra point and the missed field goal, so you feel like, on the road.
That was Rashid Hageman, by the way, who blocked that. I'm like, man, that guy actually did something.
And the toughest environment in football. So that was the other thing that was nice to see because, look, Matt Ryan got beat up in the first half. He got beat up throughout the entire game.
Matt Ryan is so tough, man. I got to do an aside here because that guy gets hit more than anyone, and most of the time he just pops right back up.
Yeah, no, I mean, he looked great. And sort of throw three touchdowns coming back from that, and it just shows that they made some sort of adjustments in the second half or at halftime to score those touchdowns. The Troy Lolo,
the adjustment was they started getting Julio involved in the game.
Right, but they had the ability, whether, you know, I don't, whatever it was,
yeah,
to their offense started moving the ball. And that's impressive in and of itself, just to come back from 14 points down on the road in Seattle. Like I said, it's the toughest environment. You know, if you want to call it not the toughest, it's in top three or five.
Oh, it's the toughest.
In the NFL at CenturyLink Field. So, look, the Falcons come back after this game 4-2. I said before we went to Denver, if you could somehow split that and come back 4-2, now you just have to take care of business at home against teams that you should beat. You should beat the Chargers this weekend. And
you should beat the Packers, too.
The Packers are right. That's what I'm saying. They haven't been playing well. So they need to, you know, hold rank at home, win those games, and then you look at them. I feel like they're a legitimate team now.
Of course.
If they could do that, I would say the best teams in the NFL, best teams in any sport, are the ones that beat the teams they should beat and then beat the teams, you know, play against the Seattle the way they did. Obviously, they didn't come up with the W, and I know people don't like moral victories, but if there was ever a moral victory in sports, this Falcons team in Seattle, I think you could call it pretty close to that.
Yeah, look, this is a team that is clearly led by their offense. There are still some defensive inadequacies and problems that hopefully going into this offseason, going into next season, will be fixed. But yeah, this team is young on defense too, so that's a good sign, having some veteran presence on there to kind of bring these young guys along. But yeah, like you said, obviously the pass interference, which should have been called, and I saw that Dan Quinn said they were going to send the video to the league, and I hate that because, yeah, what's the league going to do? Write you a letter back, hey, Dan, we messed up, sorry. You know
right.
what I mean?
It's one of those things after the fact that nothing good can come out of it other than if you just change the way the rule is, or if you – now there's been sparking the conversation of, do we start to review pass interference? Do we do it under 2 minutes? Does it become a play that can be reviewed throughout an entire game like any of these other reviewable plays?
I think within 2 minutes would be a pretty reasonable thing, just because you don't want people reviewing pass interference, because that's something that – obviously you only have a limited number of challenges, but –
Right, and it's just one of those calls that gets called so often that if you're doing that, you know, in the middle of the second quarter with 8 minutes left, it just slows the game down already.
I would just call it, you know what, anything that can be deemed a game-altering play inside of like 2 minutes should automatically go to booth review, just like every score is now reviewed, just like every...
Well, the problem is, though, then you might have like a holding call. You know, let's say you score a long touchdown, but it's clearly a hold, and that could be a game-altering play because you score a go-ahead touchdown.
Well, I think I meant more in terms of like game-altering, like a big throw downfield. I'm not talking about like individual things. There would be some things you'd have to put into the language of the rule in terms of, all right, we're not reviewing this, we're not reviewing that. Because, yeah, Mike Florio, you know, or Pro Football Talk, had an article where they were like, well, Julio hit Richard Sherman on the helmet before he took off on his route, so that should have been looked at as part of the play, too. And it's like, first of all, inside of that 5 yards, there's probably a penalty every single play between receivers and corners, you know, duking it out, trying to get positioning. So that was a stupid thing to say. And the other thing they were trying to say was you need to be able to look at the whole play. I'm like, well, that's ridiculous, because when you have, like, a fumble, for example, and you're reviewing who got the ball, what if on review you see a holding penalty? You know what I mean? Like, no, we're not doing that. So I thought that article was pretty
Mike Florio, you're an idiot.
Well, I'm just saying. I thought, you know, Mike Florio always tries to be the guy to upset the apple cart, you know, and he's always the contrarian. So I thought that was just a really weird thing. Obviously, he's just trying to, you know, troll from the other side of things, and I guess I get that. But still, it was just a weird way to go about it. But yeah, there was a lot of good to come from this game. The Falcons' inability to run the ball against Seattle is a little concerning. But I mean, Seattle's one of the best run defenses in the NFL. It's kind of like Georgia against Vanderbilt, where that's the thing that they do best, is really like stopping the run.
Right, and at least the Falcons are multifaceted on offense, where they can, you know, if the running game is not working one day, then they throw the ball. So you don't feel that they're pigeonholed into one side of whether it's throwing or running. Also, gotta give it up to Dan Quinn. For as much as I've talked poorly about him, his reaction to the Julio Jones play,
it was perfect.
I wanted to run into the game and like hug him.
Yeah, I wanted to like give him a high five, be like, "Yeah, coach!"
Because I was so happy that he finally showed emotion, and he was irate.
He was furious
that they didn't call it. Now, after the post game press conference, he kind of tiptoed around
a little bit.
But look, that was an awesome reaction from Dan Quinn. You felt that he was finally, like, wasn't just fast physical.
Yeah.
We're going to play fast physical. So I was excited to see that. I love that emotion out of your head coach, especially when something bad happens, because you feel like, okay, he's got my back. He's willing to go to war for me.
A little bit of a step back for the defense in terms of pass rush and things like that. You know, they played so well against Denver, and they had a couple chances to get Russell Wilson, and they couldn't. And there was one play in particular where I think this was on the drive that they got the field goal to take the lead, where Christian Michael ends up catching like a little screen pass where I think it was Freeney and somebody else, I can't remember who, but they both should have had Russell Wilson. Instead, he extends the play a little bit and dumps the ball off to Michael, and that was a huge play in the game.
And that's the thing. Russell Wilson is one of the more elusive quarterbacks in the NFL, and so with a pass rush that's not as good as the Falcons, you know, if you really can't keep him in the pocket, that you're hurting in that sense. Fortunately, this week we get Phillip Rivers, who is not known as somebody who's going to scramble.
Statuesque.
And then the week after, you get the Green Bay Packers, Aaron Rodgers, who's really struggled, though. If you look at his last... You know, I saw a side-by-side comparison. They play the Bears this week, and a side-by-side comparison of him and Brian Hoyer over the first, I guess, we're 6 weeks into the season. Brian Hoyer has better numbers. Like you said, the Packers are not the team that, you know, everyone thought they might be. But both teams, the Packers and the Chargers, will be coming off Thursday games when they play the Falcons, so they'll have a little bit more rest. You can kind of look into that however you want. Some people look at it as a negative for the Falcons that teams get 10 days, you know, before they play us, and some people will say, well, I'd rather play just week to week and continue the role that we're going on. So just as a little tidbit, the Chargers had played last Thursday against the Broncos, and then the Packers will play this Thursday and then play the Falcons next week.
Yeah, and it's like we said, there's definitely some games coming up that the Falcons need to win. And I have some interesting little tidbits that I got here from Mike Conti, who does, I think, the Falcons radio stuff.
Like the pregame, yeah.
Yeah, he had these notes on Twitter. The Chargers are only 1-8 all-time against the Falcons. And also, Phillip Rivers is 0-4 in his career in fixed-dome stadiums, which means no retractable roof.
What a stat.
We looked those up this morning, those games, and two of them were against New Orleans. One of them was against the St. Louis Rams, and then the other one was against Minnesota.
Okay.
So Phillip Rivers, not very good in fixed domes, and that could maybe bode well for Atlanta.
Yeah, I mean, look, up until last week when the Chargers beat the Broncos, everybody felt that the Chargers' pulse was pretty much, you know, on life support, and that of Coach Mike McCoy. So the Chargers are a team that, if they're leading in the fourth quarter, the Falcons have every chance to win the game, because they found every way to blow these fourth quarter leads. They lost a big lead to New Orleans. They lost the game in Kansas City, the opening game, when they were up 21 points in the second half. So the Chargers are a team that if they get a lead, Falcons fans, don't worry. We'll come back.
Yeah.
We'll beat them.
That's
it's
right.
Going to be okay.
But that's the thing. You've got to hope that there's no kind of letdown factor for the way that they lost this past weekend, because you don't want to come out sluggish, and obviously this is a 4:05 kick, so that, you know, might help in terms of not being an earlier game. You have, you know, a little more time to get ready in the day and things like that. But the Falcons, it's been interesting that the Falcons have had these 4:00 and 4:25, and they'll have another one later on in the year when they take on the 49ers at the Georgia Dome. That'll be a later on kick as well. And that Packers game got flexed into
4:25, right.
The America's Game of the Week.
I know, the Cowboys are not, they're playing Sunday night, we looked it up, because I said, well, there's no way the Cowboys are playing.
Of course.
And they're not the America's Game of the Week.
Yeah, that's a good point there. But yeah, the flex for the Falcons, and I think the original game there was Carolina's game, and they end up getting moved back to 1 o'clock, and oh boy, Carolina Panthers, 1-5, Cam Newton with his... He's storming out of that press conference, and that's going to be an interesting kind of dumpster fire to pay attention to for the rest of the year, because, you know, we saw Cam Newton after the Super Bowl say I'm a bad loser and all that stuff. Well, it's going to be a lot of losing this season, it seems like.
Yeah, 1-5 from the, you know, I guess NFC champions, the team that you thought was going to win the Super Bowl. That's the best part about sports, is that every time you think something's going to happen, there's always teams that come out of the shadows. Look, we talked about this before we got on the podcast today. At the beginning of the season, Georgia was a team we were like, okay, we're going to end up spending 30 minutes on Georgia every week and maybe talk about the Falcons. Maybe we'll say the score and say we're really disappointed in how bad and how poorly they're playing. Now we come in, it's like, well, maybe we'll spend 5 minutes on Georgia, and let's just talk for 25 minutes about how awesome the Falcons are.
No, it's a great thing about the NFC South. It flips around a lot. Flips around a good bit. Worst to first and first to worst happens a good bit. All right, Ryan, you got any parting shots here?
No. Well, I guess I do. If you're a Falcons fan, be excited. don't even be cautiously optimistic. Let's just be optimistic. Let's enjoy this ride the Falcons are on. Let's give Dan Quinn, Kyle Shanahan a little bit of credit. We can even give Thomas Dimitroff a little bit of credit. This draft seems to be one that has actually produced some good players between the linebackers. Austin Hooper and Keanu Neal's played well. If you're a Georgia fan, yeah, just enjoy the rest of the season. Look, there's some games that we can win still. We're definitely not out of it. We're out of it in the terms of the SEC picture, but enjoy the rest of the season. Brighter things are ahead for dog fans.
Yeah, and to quote Jeff Dantzler, who you'll hear from 4 to 7 most weekdays here on 960 The Ref, got to beat Tech, got to beat Florida, got to beat Auburn. Then you can put up your Christmas tree. All right, well, that'll wrap things up for us here on the Ref Recap Podcast. Sam Franco, Ryan Goldstein, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another exciting episode previewing Georgia, Florida, and hopefully a Falcons win over the Chargers. You can find us on 960theref.com, Twitter at 960theref, Facebook.com/960theref. I'm at Sam J. Franco. He's at The Real Ride Guy 19, and we'll be back next week.